Access more.
Welcome to the Song Revolution.
Inspiring you to dive deeper into your songwriting and creativity.
To reach the world with the message of Jesus.
Here's your host, John Chisholm.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show again this week. I'm so glad you're here because I want to introduce you to a friend of mine named Sal Oliveri. Sal is a producer here in town. I got to know him about 25 years ago when he came to Nashville to play keys for a Christian rock band. But in the meantime, he has amassed a list of credits that is just beyond belief. People like Garth Brooks and Kenny Chesney, Keith Urban, Carrie Underwood, the band Perry, and on. And on. He works with people like Kathy Lee Gifford and Nicole C. Mullen, and I love Sal's perspective on artist development and bringing the best out of an artist, not putting his thumbprint as a producer on them, but letting them be exactly who God made them to be. He's a man of great faith. He's an outspoken believer in mainstream music, and I think you're going to really enjoy this interview with Sal. So, hey, thanks again for being here. And sit back and enjoy with me, our friend Sal Oliveri. Sal Oliveri, thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good to be here at Grand Central South, a beautiful home studio. I just love Nashville home studios, man. You don't even have to go downtown to Music Row anymore. Just go to beautiful Brentwood and look what we're sitting in.
Yeah, and the best part for me is the commute.
Yeah, for real, right? And the wardrobe.
Right,
you don't
yes.
have to wear your cowboy boots.
So, exactly.
Yeah, so you guys listening, if you want to see what a studio looks like, just go to saloliveri.com and you can check out a little video, see some of the folks that you've worked with. It's fun having Kathy Lee Gifford down here.
It's
very nice.
She's become quite a regular over the last few years.
Right, she lives here in Nashville, I think down in Franklin.
That's right.
There are Kathy Lee sightings. And
yeah, well, she's such a people person, you know, she waves to everybody and she tells me people come up to her and hug her all the time, which is maybe a little much, but you know, she handles it great.
Right. Well, she's just one of those people that you feel like you know.
Yes.
You know, like on your side, I watched the day on Kathy Lee and Hodo where she mentioned you and some of the work she was doing. And she is huggable. She's just one of those people.
She's extremely lovable.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for having me over here to the studio for a quick conversation. And I just want to start out asking, what's a Jersey boy like you doing in Nashville, Tennessee?
Oh, man, that's funny. That's a good one. Well, you know, I never imagined I'd end up in the South or in Nashville. It just seemed so far away when you're a kid, you know. And, you know, in college, I used to go and see concerts like everybody else. And in our local college in Pennsylvania, which was a Christian school, Messiah College, I went there my first 2 years. There were a bunch of bands that came through. So I volunteered to help set up so that I can meet the band guys. And there's a friend of mine, you know, we've been friends all these years now, a guy named Bo Cooper was playing for a few artists back in the day. And he was so nice to me. And he let me hang out the whole day. And he gave me, you know, a mailing address to stay in touch. And so I did. But I never really asked anything of him. I just wanted to be a friend. And a couple of years later, as I was finishing college, he reached out to me and said there was a band, you know, looking for a keyboard player that he didn't really, he wasn't able to take, and he recommended me. And all of a sudden, I get an audition, and I get the job, and I move south. Mm. And here I am all these years later.
Wow.
Yeah.
So from New Jersey to Pennsylvania to Nashville.
Yeah.
But before you left New York, you were actually working for a season at the Cotton Club.
Well, I did saw a gig there, which was kind of a highlight for me. In my second college in Jersey City, my jazz instructor had a production company on the side. So he was developing artists. And a lot of times, well, a few times, he would take me and maybe a guitar player from the college, and he had other guys from outside. And one of the artists was performing at the Cotton Club in Harlem. And so I drove up there in my dad's big, you know, Grand Marquee with all my gear in
I
the trunk.
Those, yeah.
Yeah, you remember those? And performed there. And I would say, you know, it's the same in African-American church, like in the black gospel world. It's the same thing in a club like that. Black audiences are some of the most exciting audiences to play for because they're there with you. And if you don't do so great, you'll know it. But if you're doing well, which thank God I happened to do pretty good that night, and they were like, go Sal, go Sal. You know, we each took a solo and I'll never forget. It was so exciting.
How fun.
Yeah. Mm. Small stage, we were crammed on there, but the energy in that room was just about to blow the roof off. And knowing the history, it's kind of the same as playing the Ryman Auditorium here.
Right.
And you realize, you know, Johnny Cash and Hank Williams and these legends from a different genre have played there. I mean, I saw Bruce Springsteen play on that stage. And
amazing.
Then to stand up there and perform, it's a similar feeling. As the Cotton Club, you just know that there's been such amazing music created in this space that it was quite a thrill.
Absolutely. The first time I walked in the Ryman, I wanted to preach. I wanted to get up on the stage. And I mean, I don't consider myself a preacher, but I felt like jumping up there and giving a gospel message or something just because of the deeply spiritual roots, deep spiritual roots of that place. It's amazing. And you have played there and you've met all kinds of people there.
Yeah.
What's that been like for you?
Well, the first time I played at the Ryman was with some Christian bands when they used to do this thing during GMA week on the Sunday night. I think it was called like the Benson Spectacular or something.
Man.
Do you remember those?
Way back. When we first met 25, 30 years ago.
Right. So I was playing maybe with Four Him or some different groups. And so that was fun. And I was pretty new to town, so I didn't really know much of the history there. So it was just like another gig in my mind. And then later I realized. But then about, I want to say maybe 4 years ago, I was writing with an artist named Annie Bosco. And she wanted to write a Christmas song. And so this was like, you know, September of that year. So we wrote this song and she said, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we could perform our song at the Ryman around Christmas time? And I said, well, sure, that would be fantastic. But she, I guess, knew a bunch of people. She had performed there maybe once before. I could be wrong about that. She calls me in December and says, you're not going to believe it, but we're performing.
Tonight.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, that week
soon,
or something.
Yeah.
So
surprise.
Here I am now performing on the stage, you know, some 2 decades later, knowing the history, performing one of my own songs. And of course, their house band's phenomenal. I mean, you know,
amazing,
I wrote a chart
right?
and we rehearse it in the dressing room and then we go out and do it. And I would say that it was different because I wasn't afraid, like, you know, when I was younger and I was, oh gosh, I don't want to mess up. I just soaked it in. I was probably smiling a cheesy grin the whole song, but I was really just able to appreciate the gift of just being able
to do
it.
Absolutely, yeah. Such a rich heritage there. Amy Grant, Vince Gill, their annual Christmas program.
Yeah.
We've seen that down there. And it's just a lot of fun and such a great time. Saw a picture on your Facebook with you and Vince when you ran
that
into
was
Vince
that night.
There. Yeah.
He always has his dressing room, I guess, right by the stage. And I came to find out that he leaves his door open on purpose just so he could say hi to people, and he enjoys meeting folks. And what a kind man. Just a kind soul.
Absolutely.
He was really nice to me.
Sure seems like that.
Yeah.
So when you look back on your life and career, who would you say might be your top three musical influences?
Oh, man. Well, going back to my roots in New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen, for sure.
Of course,
right? I love his character. I mean, the story, the character that he writes from, he's kind of like the musical Tom Joad. He fights for the common man wherever there's injustice. That's really the basis of his music. And maybe in his youth, he wrote a little bit like Born to Run, I want to get out of this town. I just want to experience things, break out of the limitations. That whole idea has, I would say, a spiritual root, whether he's aware of it or I think he is. I mean, I've heard him in interviews, but I always identified with the rawness of his music. And, you know, all my older cousins hand me down records. They gave me all his records. So I always enjoyed that. And I would say it influenced my piano and B3 playing quite a bit. Because I think I tend to play for the band. Like, I don't think of myself ever as a soloist. You know, I think, how can I make the band sound good? And those guys were just some of the best keyboard players in any band. You know, another one that probably would surprise folks is Tony Bennett, that I would say that. But my dad was a crooner.
Okay.
And we always had, you know, kind of that era, Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett, and all of my dad's favorites playing in the house. And there's something about Tony the sound of his voice, he's always so happy and cheerful. And I feel like I know him, like he's my uncle or something.
To this day.
Right?
Yeah, right.
And when I want to listen to music to forget about, like, because, you know, as musicians, we dissect continuously. Mm-hmm. I'm always in study mode. I listen to the radio and I'm thinking about that kick drum sample and, oh, that was an interesting usage of the way they EQ'd the drums to make room for the vocal. I mean, it's inescapable. But when I listen to that era of music, it just, I can take it in as a whole. I do hear the subparts, but it just makes me feel great. Mm. And so I still listen to Tony Bennett all the time. And let's see, a third one. Wow. Influence. That's a tough one. I mean, you know, I'd probably say in my formative years, maybe Michael W. Smith, actually, being a keyboard player.
Could see that, yeah.
Yeah, back in my teenage years, and he was releasing his early records. I think I looked to him to think, not that I had aspirations as an artist, but there's somebody doing part of what I want to do and with excellence and, you know, in the early days of Christian music, you know, a lot of it was subpar because there wasn't much money to put into it. And there was a lot of copycat stuff going, oh, if you like this, a secular band, you would like this.
Exactly.
You know? And Michael was doing his own thing. And I just always appreciated how he would push, you know, he would always push to stay at the edge of what was current.
How do you think those three influences have informed some of your production? If at all, I mean,
maybe not much. I wouldn't say the production side, you know, just as a fan of music, you know, those would be the three that I would maybe say have been with me as far back as I can remember, especially the first two. Mm-hmm. But there are some producers that I would say have influenced me in my philosophy. And it was me just extrapolating, like watching them. So is it all right if, you know, I mentioned a few of these folks?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would say there are two types of producers. Let me just back up and explain where I'm coming from. And they're both valid. They're both great. I'm fans of people in each of these categories. And the first one is the producer who's developed a sound and they've worked for a lot of years to perfect it and they get popular with it and then they attract artists that want the sound that this producer is famous for. And so if an artist goes to this producer, they know it's a known quantity. Oh man, they had a hit like this and I'm going to go to them and this is what I'm going to get. And it's as long as that trend is, you know, popular, they just keep going, right? And that's fine. And, you know, there are many like that that I've admired through the years. The second category, which is where I've always identified and aspired to be in, is the producer who really doesn't want to have a thumbprint on everything. They just want to make the artist the best they can be. And you mentioned Brown Bannister earlier, and I'd say Brown is in that category. Mm-hmm. When he produced Whiteheart sounded amazing, maybe their best record ever.
Right.
And then he would go and produce Amy, and then he would produce this, that, and the next thing, and they all sounded like them. You didn't hear Brown. Right. In the pop world, Phil Ramone, I would say, is a huge influence on me. He goes back as far as Sinatra and Streisand, but then he did all of Billy Joel's catalog until the very end. And, you know, he has Ray Charles, the duets record, the Genius Loves Company. He just knew how to draw the best out of each artist. And I always aspired to be that guy. And it's maybe why I work across three or four genres, because I'm not tied to a certain way of doing things, a certain sound. I'm more like a multilingual in a few genres. And so right now I have several pop, young pop artists, like Ariana Grande type pop. Mm-hmm. I have a handful of country, that some of it's classic country, some of it's modern pop country. I actually have a crooner, first time in like 20 years, a real true crooner. I'm doing this orchestral stuff with Kathy Lee that's very cinematic. And then some urban stuff here and there. And it's not that I'm trying to, you know, do everything, but those are languages that I've learned and compiled all of these different colors and sounds in my palette to help, you know, forward and advance the artist. So if you go to my playlist on my website, you probably might be surprised that one person did all those things because they're so different, and that's the point. Mm. That's always been the idea, is I want, if I'm producing you, I want them to hear the best version of John, not Sal. Okay, so some of my heroes in the production world who really said how important songs were would be like Clive Davis, who discovered Whitney Houston, Phil Ramone, of course, I mentioned, David Foster, Quincy Jones. These are the guys that I studied their albums across multiple artists. And I saw, wow, you know, really the consistent thing was always great songs and great performances. And maybe that's what David's really alluding to, was right. Moments. You can have a great song and it'd be kind of boring if there's not a real great performance behind
exactly.
it. You know, I tell some of my artists the same thing when we're recording. If I find that they're not really filling the space with their artistry, I'll say, you know, I have tools to correct pitch, to correct timing, correct volume, but I don't have a passion plugin. And so that has to come from you. And that's when you're capturing moments, when it's just something special about that take. It might be imperfect in those other ways, but there's something that moves your heart,
right?
Moves your soul and makes you feel something. Really, I have three sets of speakers in my studio. I've got the big, you know, the big ones that make everything sound fantastic. And then you got some medium ones. And I got like basically a little desktop that's almost like listening through a phone. And often I'll check it there, because if that moves you through that little speaker and it's not the bass and it's not the low end, then you know you've got something. Mm.
Now, your production credits are littered with some of the biggest names in mainstream music. Artists like Pink, Chris Stapleton, Carrie Underwood, Keith Urban, and too many to mention here, to list here, but you're an outspoken believer. How has that gone down for you in working with seemingly non-faith-based music and such mega mainstream performers? Do you ever feel like you have to set your faith aside to do the job?
I have not had that real problem. You know, I carry my faith in a very natural way. It's part of me. I don't hide it. You know, I don't use it to beat people up. I'm not critical of others, you know. So I don't really have any issues. And I would say, because I'm a believer, I'm always looking for an opportunity, but not wanting ever to force one. So, you know, I talk very openly about my family, or, you know, if I'm praying about something, or, you know, that's just part of my everyday conversation. So what I found is there's quite a thread of faith through many of the artists that I've come in touch with in the pop world, in the country world. You know, just because they're singing about, you know, whatever topics they're singing about, sometimes we just don't really know that, boy, they were raised in the church and they really do have a faith of their own. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually found a lot of common ground. And then I find that, you know, there are those that subscribe to different set of beliefs, you know, universalism, or they are, you know, just the universe is going to do something. And it's funny, because when I talk about, well, I see what you're saying, you know, you're speaking this into the universe and hoping the universe blesses you. I just think there's a personal guy up there that does those things, you know, and so we can have really great conversations. And I you know, I've never had a bad argument with anybody.
That's great. So you were part of the big Pink Chris Stapleton hit Love Me Anyway. So tell us how that all went down.
Well, Pink had come to town about 4 years ago, I think it might have been 2016, and she was writing with a couple friends of mine, Tom Douglas and Alan Chamblin. So Tom and Alan called and said, hey, would you be willing to work on this with us? And sure. So I finished both of the songs up by myself here and sort of treated them the way I felt they needed to be treated. They really just gave me carte blanche and said, here are the songs. Do your thing, which is a wonderful, you know.
Great freedom.
Great freedom to be given. And so I produced them the way I heard them. and sent them off. And, you know, the way things work, a lot of times they go through management and never heard anything. You know, a couple of years go by and I would ask Tom or Alan when I saw them out. They said, I don't know. We don't really know what's going on. So years later, all of a sudden, Tom says, hey, you know, that one of those songs is coming out by Celine Dion. I went, really? Wow. And I believe Celine had just lost her husband. And this was the first song she came out with. It was called Recovering. And I can only imagine maybe Pink and was with her and said, oh, you should hear this song, whatever. So, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't a part of the Celine recording, though I would say, you know, in so many words, it was pretty much an exact replica of my demo. So
done.
You just go, hey, that happens sometimes in the world. And all I can imagine is, you know, sometimes an artist hears a song and it hits them emotionally and they just say, I want to do it just like this, which I took as a compliment. So I thought, well, that's wonderful. So then some time went by and Pink's manager reached out and said, you know, that other song that you did for us, we just love. Pink's thinking about putting it on a record. So, you know, we kind of worked out our business stuff and I sent my files over and I had played piano and bass and done a little string arrangement. And so Pink, I don't really know if she was the one that added Chris to make it a duet because the version I did was just all Pink singing the whole song.
Right.
And, you know, and I knew it was a pretty special song, but, you know, we hear a lot of special songs. There's so many things that have to align for something to be a hit. So when the album came out, you know, I went on iTunes and was just blown away because she had another single running at the time on the radio, but that one song was like number one on iTunes for quite a while. And it just told me like, wow, the people really like this. And what's also fun as a producer is I resisted overproducing it. And they did as well because they did some work on it after I sent the files over. And really, it was just my piano part and her vocal that were really the main components.
Right, right.
The bass is just adding some low end in the choruses. The strings are pretty subtle. The steel's pretty subtle. But the stars are the song and Pink and and Chris. And then I felt like I just probably put the most time into that piano part. It needed to be beautiful and set a mood without ever stealing the attention from them. And that just took a little time of finding the right place for it. So it's been great. I mean, the album did great for her. It was a number one for her. The song was number one for a while on iTunes. Mm-hmm. And it did quite well on radio as well. So it was a thrill. I mean, I was getting my hair cut recently and it came on the radio and my buddy Richard was like, you ever been down to Richard Dion's place on Main Street in Franklin?
I have not.
Dion South. He's such a great old friend of mine. And he goes, hey, this is you, ain't it? And I'm like, yeah, man, it's me. And it's just a thrill. You know, it's really fun.
I love that. Well, what an interesting story that it took years.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And something that you might have just forgotten about.
Right.
Kind of took on a life of its own, and also so many different people touching the work.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really true. And I have to say, you know, I was part of a team on that. I mean, there was a handful of people in there. I'm one, you know, Pink, she's my favorite of all of the power pop, you know, artists through the years. And her sensibilities are just great. Her instincts are great. The way she emotes is great. So, you know, I was thrilled to just be a part of the team on that. Yeah, you know, that's an understanding that people just don't know about. By the time it gets to the consumer, sometimes it's been through a lot of different hands,
exactly.
And it can crumble at any stage. You know, the first, not to skip around, but the first oratorio that I did with Kathy Lee Gifford and Nicole C. Mullen was the feature artist. When it was done, I was amazed at how excellent it was. And I give the credit to Kathy. She would spread the credit around, but you know, a lot of times when it has to go through, oh, well, now there's a film and there's a director and there's this, there's, you know, all these different moving parts, it can turn into a big ball of cheese real fast, you know. And when things stay pure to the end, you know that there's been someone involved who's really taken care of that.
The champion.
Right.
Right, yeah. Walking that through. Well, that must be interesting. How's it been working with Kathy Lee and Nicole C. Mullen?
Well, it was excellent. There's a little behind the scenes for people that are interested in, I won't, you know, talk all about it, but the first one that we did was called The God Who Sees. And it was a little song, I mean, a verse and a chorus, a couple of verses and a chorus. Kathy Lee came in with Nicole, and they said, hey, we want to just make a little recording of this, just like document it. And I said, okay, sure. So when they started playing it, I thought, man, you know, there's not much structure to this. So my wheels start going. And then they were talking about doing some narrations, and I quickly realized, oh, we're not doing like a 3-minute song here. This is like something else, and we didn't know what it was. So finally, Nicole said, you know, why don't I just go into the live room, and I have a good visual between the glass and where I'm sitting at the piano and where she's singing. Let's just improvise it like a performance. And I played enough in church behind preachers or, you know, worship leaders, and, you know, when you have to improvise and underscore.
Exactly.
I've done hours, countless thousands of hours of this.
Emoting through your fingers.
And Nicole and I had not ever recorded before, but we have a similar sensibility. So she narrated like off the cuff, knowing I'm going to talk about Ruth. And I was underscoring her just by listening. And, you know, when you just two become one, when you're really like, that's what the Holy Spirit does for us. He unites us. And it was the same musically. And 11 minutes later, when we got through this thing, and I spontaneously came up with interludes and key changes and intros. I mean, you know, you just go, wow.
Right.
It's one of those like when we were told, you know, when we go to witness even, don't worry about what you're going to say. The Holy Spirit will be there to help you. I felt that same kind of empowerment musically.
Wow.
Of just drawing from the things that I had known through the years and being able to apply them on the spot, right? Same thing. So Kathy immediately said, oh, I know what we're going to do with this. This is amazing. She saw the whole thing. So a year later, you know, we're in Israel. She's filming this whole thing. And it released, I think, 2 Easters ago or maybe 1 year ago, Easter. And it's, I just would encourage people to go to godwhosees.com. I think it's .com. And watch the 11-minute film, watch the little behind the scenes. It's breathtaking. And this is what I'm talking about. It went through a lot of different people. I had to hire an orchestrator. So I had my piano and her vocal. And then Philip Kevren, who's a brilliant orchestrator, came in and wrote a beautiful, like, full symphony orchestra arrangement to it. And we had wonderful engineers. And Kathy directing for the very first time. And she's a natural. I mean, it's just so well done. And it's not boring. Like, you know, 11 minutes of one song.
And it all started right here with you and Nicole C. Mullen improvising, basically.
And we basically got through 11 minutes, and I think we maybe fixed 2 little spots where she wanted to change a word.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And, you know, we're working on 4 others that are not that way. They're more constructed. And they're just, they all have their own personality, and they're all fantastic. You know, some really great people involved with those as well. So it's been fun. It's a little different, you know, and I love working with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra as well. They're just the top of the top musicians. Mm. We're blessed in this city.
We are.
We have so many talented, gifted people.
Well, my next question was going to be your favorite session of all time, but you may have just described it. I don't know. Is there anything that can top that spontaneous moment with Nicole?
You know, this, I don't mean to sound corny or anything, but while the sessions are fun, I mean, I love my job, don't get me wrong, they're all fun to me. I can find something to enjoy in every situation, but there are some moments that stand out to me, and it's usually focused on the artist or the content creator. It's usually the artist who sees it for the first, the realization of all of it coming together. There's an independent artist from Texas, young girl, came out. She had always wanted to record. She saw everyone around her advancing, and she wasn't. She felt kind of looked over. Really, it was a gifted girl, though, you know. And so circumstances worked out. She was able to come and record a couple songs with me. And the first time I played her finished vocal, I had her sing, coached her through it, and then I assembled it and put it all together. You know, we take the best little chunks of each performance and call it comping. And when she sat on my sofa and listened, she just burst into tears. It's like a lifelong dream. Mm. That's a moment for me. Mm-hmm. That fuels me. And it doesn't matter if it's her first time. You know, seeing that thing I explained with Kathy Lee and Nicole, and seeing things come together, you know, I look at what I get to do less like being like on a factory line manufacturing things. I look at it more like I'm in the birthing room where babies are being born, and it's such a privilege to help people bring things into the world. I know it sounds a little corny, but it really is what drives me. Mm. It's what makes me get up every day and be excited about what I get to do, because it's the helping people reach their goals, or helping them tell their story, or helping them, you know, get to the place they want to get. That's really everything for me to do. Mm. So someone comes to me, I don't look at my job as a producer to redirect them into what I think is going to benefit me. It should be, all right, what's unique about you? What's different about you? What's your story? Why do you make music? Why are you in this place? Why are you coming to me to record? I want to know all of those things, because that will help me get an idea of maybe what's in their next 18 months to 2 years down the road. And I want to make a record for that purpose. So the goal is not making great sounding music. The goal is making music that's great, that represents them as a person, as an artist, that they'll be able to move forward with and do what they're called to do. Really, that's the whole thing for me.
All right, so here's another Facebook post. Okay. I've been like creeping all over your Facebook.
I appreciate
it.
It's
how you get to know people, yeah. Right? So, love your enemies, difficult words, impossible words. Why would God give us such an impossible command? Number one, because it would require us to rely on Him. Number two, because it's the only way to break the cycle of hate and violence. Mm. Darkness cannot light up an already dark room. If anyone's brand of progress involves hate, bullying, or silencing others, they need to check themselves. Only light can dispel darkness, and only love can diminish hate. Mm. There's only one source of love. Get yourself a healthy dose and start generously giving it away.
Mm. Wow.
Cool stuff, Sal. So what's your take on how the music you make has any part of generously giving that love away?
Well,
And where does that come from?
It's an interesting question, and it's a good one. I think that when I stand before God one day and He calls up a date, you know, this is a hypothetical, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek image here, but I imagine it like plays like a movie, like God says, hey, St. Peter, pull up July 12th, 2020. I don't think God is going to say, let's hear the record. I think He's going to look and say, how did He treat those people in the room that day? And that's the image that I carry with me, is how I treat the people. Do I really value them? Do I lift them up? Hopefully they leave better than the way they came. I think that's really what it's about. And that requires listening and caring. And it's a discipline and it's a posture. So, you know, what the music's going to do is what the music's going to do. I don't have any control over that, meaning that I'm going to give my best effort. But what I want is for the music to feel alive. And the way it feels alive is by it not being contrived and by it not being manipulated. And so there's all these things and these techniques that people try and do to up their chances. But if it's at the expense of authenticity, then it's for nothing. Mm. So what I really concentrate on is, hey, let's do things that, in the simplest way, that work. That means that this song is a great song, but it's a great song for you, and you sound great on it, and it's going to help you tell your story, right? All these things are in line, and then, you know, of course, the music stuff, that's just the fun part. It's like I get the best musicians I can get, and we do our thing, and it's fun, and it's great. And what it does after that, I have no control over. But what I do have control over is the atmosphere in which I work, and with people and the people that I bring in, the teams I assemble. I want it to be life-giving. I want people to, I mean, I hear it all the time, and it's not by accident. It's not a pat on the back, I'm breaking my arm to pat myself on the back. People say, this is the best recording experience I've ever had, or this is the most me I've ever had. Mm. And And it's because that's what I try and do. I really try and make it a great experience. It doesn't mean we don't work hard. You know, I might make them sing it 25 times, but it's not like a taskmaster. It's because I believe that it's in them. And when people sense that kind of faith in them, they rise to the occasion.
Okay, so chicken with pancetta and cherry tomatoes over a bed of spinach sauteed in olive oil and garlic.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
Let's talk.
Yeah. All right. So my wife and I had to change our diets radically about 10 years ago, and we both got off gluten and most dairy. I mean, butter is okay. Romano cheese is okay because it's aged and it's sheep's milk. Anyway, so we have to find creative ways to make tasty food that doesn't include bread and cream, which is really hard and a cruel twist of fate on an Italian, I will tell you that. My wife's not Italian, but from speaking for me.
Right.
So, you know, we were talking, my gosh, we have chicken all the time. You know, how can we make this different? And she had an idea with the pancetta because that gives a nice salty flavor. And then I said, what about some, you know, cherry tomatoes and da-da-da? And the bed of spinach was, well, we can't put it over rice. We can't put it over pasta. But I need something else to, like, fill me up. And so the spinach was born.
There you go. Well, and a beautiful picture, man.
Well, thanks.
Oh, the things you can learn creeping on Facebook.
Oh, boy. But, yeah, it was good.
It looked good. Makes me hungry talking about it.
Well, it's a good lesson in life. You know, I love metaphors. And I love analogies. Limitations are good, you know. Sometimes limiting your options helps you to be a little more creative with what you have. It's the same in cooking. It's the same in music. It's the same in life. You know, necessity is the mother of invention is another one. It's like, well, you have a need. Well, get off the couch. You know, these things can motivate.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I've had my share of hard times and knocks. And I can't say that I never have had a woe is me, you know, a little pity party. But ultimately, no one's going to do for me what I need to do for me. I could pray till I'm blue in the face, but, you know, I have to partner with God. God can only do what he can do, but he's not going to do my job.
So good. So good, Sal. All right, last question, man. You ready for it?
Yeah.
Are you sure that was the last analogy for the day?
I don't know, man. I got a lot of them.
Jeez, I love it. Well, all right. So what's the one thing that you wish the world knew about you?
Well, I don't know. It's something they don't know. I wouldn't say outspoken. I'm pretty, you know, I don't hide who I am. The things that are most important to me would be my family. You know, I love my wife and I love my four kids and they're unique creatures and just God made them so beautifully and they're gifted in unique ways, and one of the greatest thrills in my life and privileges is helping all these things I talk about for artists is I instill into my kids. Like I just see, oh wow, God's gifted you this way. How can I help you, you know, reach these goals that you have? And that's probably what's most important to me. That along with, and that really stems from my relationship with God through Jesus is, you know, hey, so much grace was poured on me. I mean, I don't deserve, you know, to be in the family of God. I don't deserve an eternity with Christ, but I've been given this incredible gift and I just want to share it. And those are the two things that really are what sustain me. My wife prays for me every day. She's not musically inclined. She doesn't come in here and critique my mixes, you know, but she intercedes for me on a daily basis. And I don't think I would have had anywhere near the open doors and successes that I've had it not been for her. So I would just tell people, you know, again, I'm always thinking, how can I help folks? I mean, link yourself with good people, you know, develop good teams, talented people, if it's for business, but people that care about what you care about and that are going to help you, that are going to value what you have as much as you value it.
Mm. So good. Sal, thanks so much for being on the show today. And anyone interested can go to saloliveri.com, read about you, see some of the artists you've worked with, your playlist of your current music, and just congratulations on not only a great career, but just the way that you exude the spirit of Jesus in what you're doing. So thank you so much, man.
You're welcome. Thank you, John. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Song Revolution podcast, designed to help you live a more inspired and meaningful life.
Subscribe now and share this podcast with the creatives in your circle.
You can connect with John Chisholm on Facebook or
visit NashvilleChristianSongwriters.com to take your songwriting to the next level.